It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's September, and a man is flying to meet his wife, but the plane will never reach its destination, and no one on board will survive. This event will change history, though it's not the event you're likely thinking of. Because though the plane is small, the man on board is well known. He's a powerful man, a builder of great wealth and fame. But what Mohammed bin Laden will never know as his plane crashes southeast of Mecca in late 1967 is that in a few short decades, his family legacy will change from one of construction to one of destruction.
From the Fox News Podcast Network. Fox News Rewind, 9/11.
Good evening. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It was nearly 10 years ago that a bright September day was darkened by the worst attack on the American people in our history.
The president did unleash the psychological version of shock and awe with that attack aimed directly at Saddam Hussein himself.
We will be focused on finding the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban leadership in Afghanistan.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
There is a plane that has been hijacked. It is 20 minutes south of Washington and is headed this way.
An incredible plane crash into the World Trade Center here at the lower tip of Manhattan.
17 American servicemen killed by two suicide bombers whose boat rammed the USS Cole on October 12th.
This morning at 10:30 a.m., the heart of Nairobi was actually ripped apart by a bomb.
It was an explosion of extraordinary magnitude that ripped through the underground garage beneath the huge World Trade Center complex.
Starting in 1979, the Soviets poured more than 100,000 soldiers into Afghanistan. Seeing it as part of the communist creep, America trained and bankrolled the Mujahideen to resist.
Episode 1, The Origins of Terror.
أن الحقيقة ما ذكرتها سابقا أن أحداث منهاتن كانت ردا على قتل التحالف الأمريكي الإسرائيلي.
Osama bin Laden was born in Saudi Arabia for a father who basically came from Yemen.
Former FBI Supervisory Special Agent Ali Soufan.
His father was a Yemeni Saudi who became one of the wealthiest people in Saudi Arabia after the royal family. His mother was a Syrian, and bin Laden was the middle child of 52 children that Mohammed bin Laden had, the father. He lived actually a life without his dad. His dad died when bin Laden was young. I think the dad died in 67. Bin Laden was very young at the time. And his mother and his brothers were basically the family that that he has. Osama bin Laden grew up as a member of one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia.
Osama bin Laden was born in Saudi Arabia to a very large, wealthy family and conservative. So they were religiously very conservative.
AEI fellow and advisor to Critical Threats Project, Catherine Zimmerman.
His radicalization process that began really, I would say, while he was in Saudi Arabia. He met a preacher, Abdullah Azam, who's actually known as the father of jihad while in Saudi Arabia. And after bin Laden graduated university, was convinced to go to Pakistan to join him in the Afghan jihad. And it was exposure to the more conservative Salafi, and I would say Salafi jihadi concepts that Abdullah Azzam and those around him espoused, that really brought bin Laden to be the person that we know today.
قوات الإمارة الإسلامية بعزم وإصرار وتوكل على الله.
Ayman al-Zawahiri was an early member of the Muslim Brotherhood, the dissidents in Egypt.
Fox News Sunday anchor Chris Wallace.
He was jailed for his opposition to the leadership of Anwar Sadat and Hosni Mubarak.
Ayman al-Zawahiri is an Egyptian doctor. He comes from a very wealthy and very rich family. His father was a known surgeon. His mother was also the daughter of the president of Cairo University and the founder of King Abdulaziz University, which is the only university at the time in Saudi Arabia. His father was an ambassador to a few countries. His great-grandfather or his grandfather's brother was one of the founding members of the Arab League. So he comes from a really, aristocratic family, if you want to call it, very educated family, a very well-known family in Egypt.
He actually joined the Muslim Brotherhood when he was quite young, when he was a teenager. And the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was very active in trying to transform how the Egyptian government was organized to instill more Sharia law, that's law based on Islam, the religion. And he rapidly actually became disabused of the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood's path forward, which was nonviolent, was going to be effective. And you see him, he gets rounded up in an effort by the Egyptian government to quell Islamist dissent. He spends a couple of years in prison, during which time he really came out a changed man. And it's actually notable within the jihadi circles that while he was in prison, he certainly spoke to his interrogators about his network. And facilitated the role of additional Islamists.
At a young age, he started to be very into Sayyid Qutb's teaching. Sayyid Qutb was an Egyptian intellectual early on in his life. He did not show an indication of radicalization. I think a lot of his views shifted after he traveled to the United States and studied in Colorado. He had not a lot of good things to say about the U.S., about American culture, and he believed that the U.S. is a nation without values. So when he came back to Egypt, he started to look into Egyptian traditional values that he found in Islam. That created a problem between him and the secular government at the time of Jamal Abdel Nasser, the socialist government. And that led into a crash between him and between Jamal Abdel Nasser. He was arrested for conspiring against the regime, where he was tortured. And, and then he was released and then was arrested again for his role in ordering an assassination against Jamal Abdel Nasser. After that, he was executed. His experience in jail created a shift in the views of many in the Muslim Brotherhood. So Sayyid Qutb, because of the torture that he endured in prison, he believed that there is no Muslim can torture another Muslim the way that he was tortured. So those people who are torturing him are not Muslims. They are living in Jahiliyyah, which is the time before Islam. And thus, they need to be fought and they need to be killed. And this is where the concept of the takfir came. So we start seeing many of those Islamists who want to declare war on other Muslims, to include their own government, using the ideological justification of Sayyid Qutb in doing so. And that's how Sayyid Qutb impacted the thinking of Ayman Zawahiri.
But he comes out of prison and understands that he needs to use violence to achieve his aims. And he is part of this group known as the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. And over time, he becomes the leader. But really, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad was never quite successful inside of Egypt. And most of that was a reflection of both the Egyptian security services and also the violence that the jihadists inside of Egypt were imposing upon the civilian populations. So, you know, this becomes critical to the development of Ayman al-Zawahiri and his idea of how you can be successful in this line of work.
1979 had many events that contributed to everything that we saw later with the rise of Islamization, if you want to call it, in the Muslim world. So first, it starts with the Iranian Revolution in February of 1979 and the return of Khomeini to Iran. That created for the first time an Islamic government, an Islamic republic, which was a dream for many Islamists around the Muslim world, even though that government was a Shia government, but it inspired Sunni activists in so many different places around the world. The second one was the Camp David Accord, which really angered so many people in the Muslim world, especially the Islamists, and eventually led to the assassination of the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat by Egyptian Islamists in the armed forces, and many of them were caught, and Ayman Zawahiri was one of those people who allegedly conspired to kill Anwar Sadat. The third event that took place was the seizure by Wahhabi extremists of the mosque in Mecca. And they, you know, kept many, worshippers hostages until the mosque was liberated by reportedly French troops, French paratroopers, who went and aided the Saudis in taking back the holy site. The fourth event was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Afghanistan's really been at the crossroads of histories for centuries and centuries. It's only been together as a country since about the 1700s, mid-1700s.
Fox News senior foreign affairs correspondent Greg Palcott.
It's better to describe it as a patchwork of warlords, chieftains, ethnic tribes, and divided along sort of geographical lines, too. You have the Pashtuns in the southwest and covering a lot of the desert area down there, too. Up in the mountains, you have the Tajiks. Out in the west, it's an area called Herat, a city and a region that blends right into that country next door, which is Iran. To the east, of course, there's Pakistan, and to the north there's Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, China even. It was really a crossroads of all empires moving in and moving out, and that's how it got its name of Graveyard of Empires, because people tried to conquer these guys, but they're tough fighters, and they did not go down with a fight, and the other guys did.
This was the height of the Cold War. And at that point, there were two predominant ideologies in the world and two spheres of influence, the Soviet communist and the American democratic or capitalist.
Fox News Channel correspondent Amy Kellogg.
And Afghanistan was, and frankly, as you know, still is, a very traditional and tribal society. And it slipped into the Soviet camp after a coup in 1978. And the point of the coup, which brought in a communist government, was to modernize Afghanistan. But it became a very repressive situation very quickly. And for that reason, and also for the fact that modernizing clashed with traditional Afghan culture. There was a lot of pushback. And Moscow began to worry that Afghanistan might switch sides and start to cozy up to the United States. So it sent in its troops, and a quagmire ensued for about a decade. And many people say it was the USSR's Vietnam and a real drain on finances. It was a death trap for soldiers. And frankly, it really was a seminal event, though. I think everyone would agree in the downfall, the eventual collapse of the regime, the Soviet regime.
Many countries around the Muslim world saw an opportunity because of the unrest that these Islamists are creating in places like Egypt or places like Algeria or places like Morocco or places like Saudi Arabia, with radical Wahhabis now rebelling and trying to take holy sites, worshippers as hostages. They saw an opportunity to basically export all their problems and all the radicals that they have to go and fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, you had radical Wahhabis who went there, but also you had Egyptian Takfiris who went there. Some people who are so Puritan in their views of Islam, and some people believe that that's not enough. You need, if you have a Muslim who is not in accordance to your views of things, that Muslim is an enemy and they need to be killed. So that kind of was the oil and the fire. These two ideologies merged in Afghanistan, and we see that merger causing the explosion that shaped most of our lives.
So when Islamabad asked Washington for help in fighting the communist, godless soldiers in neighboring Afghanistan, the U.S. obliged. They obliged by sending in aid because they just feared that there would be further rifts with Pakistan if they didn't. And these holy warriors that the U.S. came to the aid of were effectively the likes of Osama bin Laden.
The U.S. had been helping the Mujahideen, had been providing them with money, had providing them with arms, including Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And anybody who was fighting the Soviets, the U.S. supported.
Well, the United States found that there is a big opportunity to, pay back the Soviets for a lot of things that they did to us. So definitely the U.S. supported the Mujahideen and aided them and gave them weapons and, helped them to defeat the Soviets. I think without American help, I don't believe the Mujahideen could have defeated the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union will not have the quagmire in Afghanistan that it had. So from the U.S. perspective, it was essential to prevent the Soviets from taking Afghanistan and going all the way down to, the Arabian Gulf, the water on the Arabian Gulf.
Geography explains why the Soviet Union has sent an army into Afghanistan to dominate that country, and if they could, Iran and Pakistan.
So I think, after Pakistan, after Afghanistan, it's possibly Pakistan. And I think it was one of these decisions in the U.S. government at the time that we need to contain communism and prevent the Soviet Union from, expanding its geopolitical influence and expanding its territories in the Gulf region and in South Asia.
The CIA was promoting the jihadists in Afghanistan, while the FBI in the United States was investigating people who were training to go to Afghanistan.
Former Assistant United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Andrew McCarthy.
Because that's a violation of a criminal law that's known as the Neutrality Act, which means that when the United States is not at war with a country, as we were not at war with either Russia or Afghanistan, Americans are not supposed to participate in warfare activities, because obviously that can have the effect of drawing the United States into a conflict. So there was a lot of there was a lot of acting at cross purposes, I think, between our different agencies. And it starts out very early on in the 1980s with the fact that the CIA is promoting the jihad and the FBI is investigating it.
Abdullah Azzam was a Palestinian activist. He was in the Muslim Brotherhood. He was an educator. He lectured in different universities, especially in Saudi Arabia. And after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, he became the main voice for jihad in Afghanistan, advocating jihad, asking people from the Muslim world and specifically from the Arab world to go and fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan. He became the godfather of the Arab Mujahideen. And most of the Mujahideen who went to Afghanistan went because of the fatwas, because of the lectures, because of the speeches, because of the writings of Abdullah Azzam. And one of those Mujahideen who went to Afghanistan because of Abdullah Azzam is Osama bin Laden.
There were people who became infamous in later years who were key figures in the recruitment, the arming, and the financial networking that went into the Afghan jihad. Among them were the blind sheikh and Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden was a young millionaire, and he truly believed in helping the Mujahideen, and he truly believed that the war in Afghanistan is a duty for every Muslim. And that was basically because of the influence that Abdullah Azzam had on Osama bin Laden. So initially, Osama bin Laden was just a financier, a person who went there to help and assist the Mujahideen, giving them aid, giving them money. He took some construction equipment from his father's company in order to help them with, you know, road or whatever they need. He became the person that most of the money in Saudi Arabia that's coming from Saudi Arabia is funneled through him because he was a trusted individual. Osama bin Laden's story inspired so many people. This is this rich, super millionaire. His father at one point was even richer than the Saudi government itself. He bailed the Saudi government during the time of King Faisal. And there he is, leaving the life of privilege and the life of wealth behind him to go to Afghanistan and support the Mujahideen.
There's a particular terrorist attack that was aiming to assassinate an Egyptian government official that ended up killing a young girl on the street and caused backlash within the population. And it was the population's rejection of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad and its competitor, but like-minded group, Jamaat al-Islamiyah, which really kind of pushed these Islamists out. So Zawahiri then leaves Egypt. He answers a call, a very early call in the Afghan jihad for doctors to help with the Mujahideen. And he goes to Pakistan.
Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden first met in Peshawar, even though there are other stories that indicates that they met in Jeddah in 1986 when bin Laden was visiting Saudi Arabia and Zawahiri was also visiting Saudi Arabia on some, you know, kind of fundraising trip for the Afghan jihad. Bin Laden liked Zawahiri because Zawahiri comes from a very prominent family like Osama bin Laden. He's a surgeon. And also, in the same time, Zawahiri was an Islamic intellectual in so many different ways. A lot of these things bin Laden did not possess. So he saw in Zawahiri an asset, and Zawahiri saw in bin Laden also a mean to get to his own end because of the money and the wealth that bin Laden had at the time.
It's very interesting to trace their relationship over time. There's this tension that's occurring in the late 1980s between Abdullah Azzam, the father of jihad, who kind of really brought the ideas of modern Salafi jihadism to light, and Osama bin Laden, who is a young, influential Saudi with connections to financing, which is incredibly important for any organization to run, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who has really cemented his ideas of what jihad is, and was looking to transform Egypt, but had fled to Afghanistan as a base. And you know, you see Zawahiri around the circle of bin Laden over the next 10 years.
Abdullah Azzam's vision was, we're in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And after the Soviets were defeated, and after the Soviet Union pulled out from Afghanistan in 1989, Abdullah Azzam's views were, okay, the jihad is over, now everybody go home. That does not fit with what Ayman Zawahiri's plans for the future are. Ayman Zawahiri believed that, now the Mujahideen defeated one superpower, and now we have to plan to defeat another superpower. Plus, most of the Mujahideens, to include Abdullah Azzam, can go back to Saudi Arabia, can go back to their countries. But Ayman Zawahiri cannot go back to Egypt. Many of the Egyptians who were around Ayman Zawahiri and around bin Laden are wanted in Egypt. And the moment they land in Cairo, they will be arrested. You have other groups also, like the Libyan fighting groups or the Algerians and the Moroccans. Those guys were also wanted by their own government. So from Ayman Zawahiri's perspective, the jihad is not over. We need to continue fighting the enemies of Islam. Abdullah Azzam's perspective was, we came here for one specific mission, to fight the infidel communists, unbelievers. We accomplished that, and now we have to go back.
And when the Russians withdrew, they announced basically in 1989 that they were pulling out, and it was clear that the Mujahideen, very much helped by an international group of nations that included the United States and Saudi Arabia, which did a lot together, not only to coordinate, but to fund the Mujahideen. When the Soviets said that they were leaving, the question was, for these Arab Afghans in particular, what do we do now?
Once the Soviets were out, the U.S. pulled out of the region, and that is seen as one of the big misjudgments.
Chris Wallace.
That had the U.S. stayed in the fight and stayed on the side of the Mujahideen, of the Islamic freedom fighters, that perhaps we wouldn't have created this enemy. But in that vacuum, the rabidly anti-Western thought and beliefs of people like Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri spread, and suddenly, instead of being an ally of those forces in Afghanistan, we become the great Satan.
The region was left awash after the war ended, and the war didn't end right when the Soviets pulled out. There was a civil war after that in Afghanistan. But effectively, the region was left awash with weapons and with refugees and children going to madrasas, and a new generation of fundamentalists were spawned. There were all of these non-Afghan, essentially Arab fighters who'd come to the region to help bring down these godless communists. And they were there, and they were fueled up, they were pumped up. And that was also part of a general destabilization of the region.
The idea that this vacuum, this interregnum, was produced after the Cold War, leading up until 2001.
Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram.
You know, there were books and takes written about, well, we don't need to spend as much on intelligence, or certainly not on defense, because we're not fighting the Soviet Union.
I come before you and assume the presidency at a moment rich with promise. We live in a peaceful, prosperous time, but we can make it better. For a new breeze is blowing, and a world refreshed by freedom seems reborn. For in man's heart, if not in fact, the day of the dictator is over.
They talked about something they called at the time the peace dividend. In other words, we could spend on education and medicine and science and other things, and that's fine. But brewing behind the scenes, and it took, you know, 11, 12 years to kind of cook this all up, nothing exists within a vacuum. And the idea that the United States was so successful through the Charlie Wilson effort and the Mujahideen and Charlie Wilson's war, as it was called, of driving out the Soviets, the people who they were basically helping gave haven to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in this failed state.
Abdullah Azzam was assassinated in a car bomb. At the time, it was confusing who killed Abdullah Azzam. Some people believe maybe it's all these Egyptians who are declaring him as an infidel. Maybe it is because of the internal war among the different Mujahideen. Hikmat Yar, one of the leaders of the Mujahideen, was also accused and possibly being behind the assassination. Some other people claimed it might be Russia. Until now, it is one of these mysteries who killed Abdullah Azzam, but he was definitely killed during a time period that was extremely important for what's going to happen later with all those Arab Mujahideen who went to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets. Now their mentor is gone, their godfather is gone, and it was definitely an opportunity for bin Laden to take charge of this movement.
The kind of really interesting thing that he did was identifying key people over time that have served crucial roles in Al-Qaeda.
Catherine Zimmerman.
Bin Laden had fingers throughout the jihadi world, so he really could look for good ideas and then try to operationalize them.
I think the most notable thing about that was that, you know, everybody in this country was kind of glad to see the Soviets run out of Afghanistan.
Fox News senior political analyst Britt Hume.
And we had allied ourselves with the insurgents, with the Mujahideen rebels. And I think it didn't occur to a lot of people at that time that Afghanistan would be a source of danger and indeed major threat to the United States. It just wasn't on the radar.
It's a shot being felt around the world. Iraq invaded Kuwait late last night.
And it was not with passionate haste, but really with a heavy heart that I had to commit our troops to Saudi Arabia. I took this action not out of some national hunger for conflict, but out of the moral responsibility shared by so many committed nations around the world to protect our world from fundamental evil.
After Saddam invaded Kuwait, Saudi Arabia felt a threat, and they felt that they could be next. So the Saudi government requested the U.S. help to protect Saudi Arabia and also to liberate Kuwait. Many countries around the world established, under U.S. leadership, a coalition in order to liberate Kuwait and contain Saddam Hussein. When that was happening, Osama bin Laden and many radical Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia were very angered because they believed that Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, is a holy place, and infidel soldiers and American soldiers should not come over to protect the holy sites and to protect the kingdom. So Osama bin Laden suggested to King Fahd at the time that he will declare a fatwa, bring all the Mujahideens who fought against the Soviets and liberate Kuwait and defeat Saddam Hussein.
Osama bin Laden, now looking for new causes, offered the Saudi government to send his jihadis to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And the Saudis said, no, we want U.S. military coming in here and basing here to help fight.
Amy Kellogg.
And Osama bin Laden was massively offended by this, thinking that it was tantamount to an invasion by infidels.
We're not walking away until our mission is done, until the invader is out of Kuwait. And that may well be where you come in.
At the time, there was a lot of feeling that we went busting in there with our military, even for the purpose of running Saddam Hussein's army out of Kuwait, which he had invaded. That we would be hated for that. But it didn't seem to turn out that way. The Kuwaitis, of course, were unbelievably grateful. The Saudis participated very much in it. We were based there. And so for a time, it seemed that and perhaps for quite a time, it seemed that the first Gulf War, which was a huge military success, had enhanced the prestige of the United States in the Middle East, that we'd come to the rescue of this small country, wasn't a poor country, but it was a small country, and that we'd come to an aid of an Arab country that had been invaded. And, you know, with the Saudis having fought alongside us and allowed us to base our military there, our situation there looked like it had been very much improved.
This morning, I am very pleased to say that coalition efforts are ahead of schedule. The liberation of Kuwait is close at hand.
So the U.S. troops came to Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden was angered by the Saudi move. He thought it was un-Islamic, and it is a violation of the teachings of the Prophet that said no infidels in the Arabian Peninsula.
Ali Soufan.
That created a problem between him and the Saudi government at the time, ended up with him escaping Saudi Arabia and going to Afghanistan. So the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, after Saddam invaded Kuwait, was a breaking point in the relationship between Osama bin Laden and the Saudis. It was the reason why he left Saudi Arabia, and the consequences of this, that many of these former mujahideens, specifically Egyptians and Libyans and Algerians, who did not have a place to go to, came around Osama bin Laden, and Al-Qaeda went from just an idea to an actual organization planning and plotting against the United States.
Next time on Fox News Rewind, 9/11.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was someone involved in a plot trying to blow up a dozen U.S. jumbo jets.
The plan started out as a potential of having a campaign of explosions throughout Manhattan. And ultimately, what they did was settle on the Trade Center.
Bin Laden was convinced that the way to get the United States out of the Muslim world was to cause America pain.
I don't believe any of us truly understood the impact of the embassy bombings in Eastern Africa. They were horrendous.
There was a lot of talk about a new world order and a lot of controversy about that, but to the most Americans, the new world order looked like one in which our mortal enemy had been defeated.
After Ramzi Youssef was arrested, he was in a helicopter. They flew next to the World Trade Center, and one person told Ramzi, "See, it's still standing." And Ramzi said, "Well, if I had more money, it won't be standing."
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.